Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on America, B.C., when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Unquote. Well, every year, the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's about 286,000 cubic miles of water pour into the oceans every year. Now, for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the circle or the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Now, that may sound very simplistic, but it is also very scientific. Now, every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and ride back to the head of their toboggan slide and to begin their journey all over again. Now, modern science, meteorology, tells us this and we understand it. Its laws are fully comprehended. But modern science has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons here in our Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. It's the place to start. The CD package is free. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and remember, it's free of charge. Call right now. The number 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email machine and send us an email request for your free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about America, B.C. In the last program, I pointed out to you that there are more than 3,000 sites here in the United States of America that we have found monuments, writings, coins, Egyptian hieroglyphics, Irish Ogham writing, Phoenician coins, Roman pottery, Norse burial mounds, and they've been found in numerous states. Not something that you found, say, in New York State or up in Massachusetts, but they've been found all over the United States. From New Mexico to West Virginia, from New Hampshire and Vermont to Georgia, Michigan, Southern Canada, all over Central and South America, Brazil. In fact, Brazil, the word Brazil is a Hebrew word that means iron land. King Solomon had trading ships bringing iron ore into Eliath in southern Israel. They found a blast furnace down there, the remnants, an ancient remnant of an oxygen-fired blast furnace, something that we didn't discover until nearly the 20th century here in the United States. Now, this ancient technology that we are discovering, I'm going to give you a couple of more examples. For instance, off of Bimini, there is a city under 60 feet of water, streets fully laid out, stone buildings built. it should be pretty obvious that whoever built that city and whenever it was built, it wasn't built when there was 60 feet of water there. It had to have been built at a time when that water wasn't there. Which means that the ocean level had to be down 60 feet or that portion of the crust sank 60 feet. Well, it could be one or the others, but I just wanted to point out, here's this ancient city here in the Americas, 60 feet underwater. Down in Peru, there is a number of peculiar sites. Monkeys and spiders and other animals that are 6 to 12 miles across. I mean, when you're down here on the ground looking at these piles of rock, 24 inches high, that when you get up in the air with an airplane, you can look down on it and see that it's a monkey, it's a spider, but you can't see it from the ground. Who built that and why? Who created stone walls in the outline of a monkey? 6 miles across, 6 miles in diameter. Who did it and when and what was the purpose? There are walls. One wall down in Peru has a stone in it. 50 tons is the estimated weight. It's an irregular stone. It isn't square. It isn't rectangular. It's an odd-shaped stone. It's just like a rock coming out of the river. And then with that rock, all the rocks around it are cut to fit it. That technology is not available in the world today, and as I speak in the year 2007, we cannot duplicate that wall today. We don't have the technology for it. The Great Pyramid of Giza, Egypt, is plus or minus a half an inch on its four corners. We couldn't measure it until 1964 with a laser telescope, laser transit, to determine how square it was. We knew it was built pretty accurately. I mean, we measured it with tape measures. But a tape measure over 14 acres isn't that accurate. So, with a laser transit, though, you can. And then we found out there are expansion joints. Who came up with the idea that heat expands stone and that cold contracts it and that you would need expansion joints in a monument or in a building that large? And without it, the stones would crack. Well, whoever built it knew it, and whoever built it had at least the technology of a laser transit of 1964. And there's one more here I wanted to point out to you. It's called Metal Workers. In Genesis chapter 4, verse 22, there is a report here of a story. Listen to this. It says, Zillah, she also bare Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron. Now, here's Genesis 4, shortly after the Garden of Eden. And these people are artificers in brass and iron. Now, when you went to school, did you hear about the Iron Age, the Copper Age, the Stone Age? Did you hear about that? And did you hear about billions and billions of years? That's what I heard when I went to school. Did you hear about Columbus discovering America? And did you hear anything about those 7 or 8 pyramids out in Illinois? Did you hear about 3,000 archaeological sites in the United States with Egyptian hieroglyphics in them? Or with Irish ogham, Roman pottery, Norse burial mounds? Did you hear about any of that? You know, our government and our public institutions, and when I say public institutions, I mean our corporations like General Motors, public institutions like our universities and colleges, you know, the public institutions like our libraries, they lie to us a lot. Yes, our government and public institutions, they lie to us continually and constantly. They lie about economics. They lie about politics. They lie about war. How many lies have we been told over the past 4 years about the Iraq war? And that's by our president. Now, our congressmen and our senators, they stand up in the halls of our public institutions and reiterate the lies of our president that we now know are lies, and we know that they are lies because now we know that the president knew, and those senators and representatives knew or should have known that what they were doing at the time they did it was, in fact, wrong and a damn lie. I say damn lie because that's the way Mark Twain put it. He said, there are lies. Then there are damn lies, and then there's statistics. And that takes us to the realm of science. They lie about economics, politics, war, the budget, diet, food, science, evolution, and they lie about archaeology. And that's the subject matter of this week's program. This takes us to a book called America BC. A guy that wrote it is a Harvard professor, like Emmanuel Velikovsky. He's a contrary guy. Well, they call those guys an iconoclast. A guy who stands up and says, "Yeah, I heard about Columbus, but it's BS. It's BS." And most of you people know what BS is. Besides Bachelor of Science, it's BS. And in the early 1970s, a group of us, this is Barry Fell speaking now in the epilogue, written in 1989. Now, he wrote this in 1989, nearly 20 years ago. He said, in the early 1970s, a group of us who were interested in ancient scripts used to meet occasionally at Harvard University to discuss the decipherment of what we believed to be ancient inscriptions. Out of these beginnings came the Epigraphic Society, formally inaugurated in 1974. And once our publications began to appear, the membership grew until now there are a dozen chapters in the United States and overseas. In this epilogue, some of the more interesting results of the Society's work are here presented. So I'm going to pause right here, make my little mark in the margin. I like to read a book by first starting off with the table of contents, and then I go to the last chapter. In this case, it's the epilogue, so that I can get the answer. So we'll start with the answer to the riddle. How's that? And in the epilogue, he starts off by saying, in this epilogue, some of the more interesting results of the Society's work are presented, because this book, you know, is about 300 pages. It's 300 and some odd pages, 350 pages. Well documented and footnoted. Furthermore, they've got the photographs and plates in here of the original sites where they took the pictures before they scraped off the lichens and the moss. That's to confound the skeptics who say that, well, it was a fake, that they made it themselves in the laboratory, took it out into the woods, and then said, look what we found. Now, these are monuments that are humongous in site, that weigh 30 tons. I saw one that Gloria Farley found over near Heavenly, Oklahoma, where she lived. And it's a huge rock. Hell, that thing must weigh 25, 30, 40 tons. It's all that a 10-wheel dump truck could haul, maybe even an 18-wheeler. And it's got this Ogham writing on it, and it's down in a little gully. And it's a state park. The state of Oklahoma is a state park. I never heard anything about it. I never read anything about that in any archaeological publications here in the United States. There is a wall of silence about these stories, about these archaeological finds of America BC, and there's a logical reason behind it. So let me share it with you. A lot of times people ask me questions like, why would the government do that? See, they can't believe it, number one. And so they come back in defense of the government because of their ignorance. See, all of us feel real bad when we find out we've been deceived, lied to. And so we have this belief system, and then when somebody challenges it, like Barry Fell, you know, or somebody comes along and challenges FDR, but why would he do that? See? Well, there's a motivation behind it. Why would the Catholic Church threaten Galileo with death if he didn't recant his scientific findings that the Earth revolved around the sun? It's control over the people who belong to the Catholic Church. The president lies to us about the war in Iraq for population or people control. That's the purpose behind it. They're in a program to create a one-world government, like we had around the Tower of Babel. And the normal people of the world, the most of the people, the majority of the people, they don't want that. And so a minority of people have to enter into a conspiracy together to bring it to pass. You know, the average American didn't want to go to war in 1938, so Franklin Roosevelt had to engineer foreign policy and the processes that work around us in international geopolitics to get the Japanese to attack us. Then we could stand up in righteous indignation and say, look what those nips did, and now we have to go to war. And the Japanese were actually responding to a 1937 policy in which the United States, along with Holland and a couple other countries in Europe, placed an embargo upon oil being exported from Indonesia to Japan. What would you think if a group of countries, let's say Russia, China, and Iran, got together and formed an embargo against the import of Middle East oil to the United States? I can assure you that war would be inevitable and probably tomorrow morning, certainly within 90 days. It's just an inevitable result. So when I heard about that, and of course I didn't hear about that in public school, I got that from the underground press. And when I saw that, I said, well, I'm not surprised that the Japanese attacked the Americans at Pearl Harbor. I'm amazed that they waited 5 years. What took so long? It was an act of war when President Roosevelt did it in 37. Why would they wait 5 years? Now, when we get over here to this epilogue in America, B.C., the question arises, why would the archaeological world, the scientific world, want to hide these Egyptian hieroglyphics found in West Virginia? They want to hide them because it doesn't fit with the political agenda. It doesn't fit with the scientific agenda. It doesn't fit with evolution. Evolution is what we've been taught in this country. The Bible has been ridiculed and impugned and taken out of our public schools because it's unscientific. Okay, boys and girls, just what in the hell is scientific about hiding Egyptian hieroglyphics, Irish Ogham writing, and Phoenician coins found in burial sites in at least 9 states in America? What is scientific about hiding the fact that the earth revolves around the sun? Boys and girls, there isn't anything scientific about it. It is the antithesis of science. And archaeology, as we know it in America today, has no more to do with science than the Catholic Church has to do with a round earth. And that's just a god-awful, bald truth of the matter. They're liars, frauds, and charlatans. Nothing more and nothing less. Now, occasionally, we get a little glimpse of reality from an insider. Now, this guy, Barry Fell, is one of the insiders. See, he's an archaeologist. He's a college professor. He's from Harvard. Harvard, as they say up in the Massachusetts area, Harvard. And so he's somebody that's got some credentials. Now, he went about this, you know, very, very slow and very, very cautiously. Having seen what happened to Emmanuel Velikovsky, he didn't want to lose his job. And so, you know, he kind of tiptoes around the tulips and tiptoes around the edges over here. He published this book back in 1976. Today, it is common knowledge. What he has reported in his book, America BC, is common knowledge. It's not accepted because it's not politically correct. You carpenters, plumbers, electricians, and longshoremen are not going to hear this anyplace else. You're not going to get it in your public schools, and your children are not going to hear this in their public schools. They're going to hear about laying the neighbor girl in the back seat of their Chevy or something, but they're not going to hear about America BC, because that would lead you to the Bible and Scripture. Now, I read to you this scripture a little earlier here about Genesis chapter 4, that they were artificers in brass and iron. Think about this for a second. When Columbus discovered America, they were casting cannon in sand. There were no turret lathes. There were no artificers in brass and iron in Columbus's time. They were not metal workers. They could cast cannon in sand. They could make spears, spear tips, and swords. But they could not make engines. They were not metallurgists. Now, here we have reported in ancient times, right after the Garden of Eden, artificers in brass and iron. Now, just take a look at the history of the world from Columbus to today. We went from casting cannon in sand to being able to make sheet steel to make ships, iron ships that float in the water. We learned how to make rivets and bore holes in steel. We learned how to make steel from iron. We have learned in 500 years how to make plates of steel by adding other elements to make them harder. We've learned how to make aluminum, and we've learned how to make brass from copper. We've learned how to use other base metals and make mixtures of metals in order to become artificers in brass and iron. We now have turret lathes and metal working machines, and we can make automobiles and engines and airplanes, and we have a technology that can take us to the moon. Or so they tell us. Well, boys and girls, if we can do that in 500 years, I want to remind you that from the Garden of Eden to the flood was 1656 years. That's three times longer. Three times the amount of time that we have gone from casting cannon in sand to flying to the moon. Now, would you logically believe then, just, you know, as an average Joe Sixpack, why then were these people who are described in the Bible as already being artificers in brass and iron? They had metallurgical technology, and this guy was an instructor of metallurgy. Why would you expect that those people then, on the other side of the flood, would have a technology any less advanced than we have in the world today, when they had three times longer to develop it than we've had from Columbus to the present time? Now, when you add to that a couple of other factors, let's take a look at the British Museum and the Cairo Museum. They both have batteries in those museums that they have dug out of archaeological digs. Batteries, boys and girls. Batteries. Electricity. In ancient times, they had batteries, which tells us they had electricity. What were they using it for? Now, the other day, somebody wrote a letter in here, and I'll comment on this letter and probably do a series of programs on it. But he asked the question, he said, if Jesus existed, notice the words, if Jesus existed, not when, but if, why don't we have more monuments? Why don't we have more secular records, you know, from Josephus or from the Romans or from the Greeks or somebody else? I mean, you know, a guy that feeds 5,000 people surely should have been written up in the local newspaper of his day. He did it three times. You know, a guy that walks on water and raises people from the dead, and Jesus did that three times. Surely ought to make some kind of mention in some local paper that ought to have been, you know, inscribed someplace, and we ought to have some secular record of him. Well, let me ask you this question in response. For 250 years, we have had Egyptian hieroglyphics, Irish Ogham writing, Phoenician coins, Roman pottery, Norse burial mounds found in West Virginia, Georgia, Michigan, Arkansas, Illinois, Iowa, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Colorado, and I never heard a word about it, and that's in the last 250 years. And now we have the teletype and satellites, and most of you have not heard of those finds. Why in the hell would you expect to hear about Jesus 2,000 years ago when you haven't heard about Roman pottery in Brazil, discovered, and, by the way, hidden by the Brazilian government because it would embarrass the academic community? In other words, hide the truth for political or religious or economic reasons. That's why you haven't heard about it in secular history, because it has been sanitized. Just like those monuments over here that I mentioned in the last program. I said I was traveling with my wife over here in Illinois, and she said, would you like to see these pyramids? And I said, pyramids? You know, I looked at her like, pyramids. Pyramids in Iowa. I mean, Illinois. Pyramids in Illinois. You know, I almost felt like saying, lady, where is your brain? Pyramids are in Egypt. Pyramids are in Guatemala. Pyramids are in Mexico City. Pyramids in Illinois. And she said, yeah, there's about 7 or 8 here. And I've been to them. I've seen them. She was from Illinois. She knew about them. I said, yeah, let me go look at it. Boys and girls, if you've never heard of these pyramids over here in Illinois, you got to go look at them. It's 400 feet high. It's shaped just like a pyramid in Egypt. And it's 1/2 acre in size at the top of it. I climbed to the top of it. I walked the 400 feet up to the top. It's a state park. I looked at this and I said, now why in the hell haven't I heard about this? I went to public school. And it's because it's sanitized. It does not fit in with the theory of evolution. It doesn't fit in with the political control of the people of America or indeed the people of the world. Now, religion controls people through their belief system. Governments are doing the same thing. They always have. They don't want you to know anything about your ancient past. That would lead you to the Bible. If you read the Bible and compared that with what we see today, the physical evidence that we see today, you would come to the conclusion that the Grand Canyon came from Noah's flood. Didn't come from evolution. I mean, that's a conclusion that you would arrive at without having been propagandized. And you'd come to that conclusion just by your 6 senses, your 5 senses. You know, women have a 6th sense. You know. You just come to that conclusion based upon reason, logic, and common sense, based upon the facts that are presented. But now, if we could hold the facts back from you, if we could keep certain facts away from you, then we could continue to propagandize you, we could continue to control you. And as we learn more about the Iraq war and the lies that led up with it, you see how the problem that government has in controlling the people and their belief and their support for the war, it is totally eroded. George Bush is totally discredited. Just totally discredited. I wouldn't believe him if he told me he was going to the bathroom. Now, Barry Fell has discovered, not that it wasn't always there, the evidence had been around for 250 years, but he started putting it together, and he formed a group called the Epigraphic Society. It was for the express purpose of putting this information together, putting it in print. It's in the underground press. You're not going to read about this in the New York Times. You won't see this in the major newspapers. You won't read about this in USA Today, and it isn't going to be reported in any of the major colleges or on the news media. But it's available. I mean, the evidence is there, and the pictures are there, and the books are written. I mean, they're not in your college libraries. Which you ought to ask the question, why isn't it in our college library? You're not supposed to know this. That's the bottom line. You're not supposed to know, but I'm going to tell you. All right, let me give you a reminder here before I tell you more that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet, and we're heard daily worldwide. Now, for more information about the Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. From the scriptural perspective, that's 8 schools in total. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our website. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of the authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book America BC by Barry Fell. Remember, you can get a copy from Barnes & Noble, I'm pretty sure, or from any used bookstore. America BC, Ancient Settlers in the New World by Barry Fell, published in 1989 as the last copyright. 1976 is the first, so between 76 and 89 for 13 years, this book has been printed. It is from Pocket Books, a division of Simon & Schuster Incorporated, 1230 Avenue of the Americas, New York, New York, 10020. Again, that's Pocket Books, a division of Simon & Schuster Incorporated, 1230 Avenue of the Americas, New York, New York, 10020. I'm pretty sure you can get a copy used from the bookstore. Now let's go back here to the epilogue. The cup and ring is a man-made stereotype motif engraved or pecked into rock, and it is composed of a central cup surrounded by one or more concentric rings. Petroglyphs of this type occur in many parts of the Old World as well as in both North and South America and on various oceanic islands. Although their meaning has been discussed since 1859 when Sir J. Gardner Wilkinson drew attention to British examples, no certain conclusions have been reached. Their occasional association with megaliths and stone circles has been held to imply a religious significance, and it has also been suggested that they may have served as markers for early mining activities. Since large numbers of examples are known from regions where metallic ores occur, and a calendric use has also been suggested. The example illustrated opposite in the upper illustration was originally found near Canton, Georgia, but has since been removed for safer conservation to the campus of the Reinhardt College in Waleska, Georgia. An article on the American examples written by British authority on the subject, Ronald W. B. Morris, appears in Volume 17, published in 1988, of the Epigraphic Society's Occasional Publications. The age of American examples cannot as yet be determined, but Morris states that the oldest example in the British Isles is believed to be at New Grange in Ireland, occurring in a megalithic tomb built around 3200 BC. The Reinhardt College example was photographed by Bart B. Henson. Petroglyphs of this kind may be among America's oldest legacies of visits by people from the Old World. Most archaeologists have sought to explain these petroglyphs as merely examples of independent invention. That explanation, if such it is to be termed, cannot apply to the next case, which is illustrated in the lower photograph in the opposite column. Cuneiform tablets of baked clay and of Mesopotamian origin have from time to time turned up in America, and they have been explained as being specimens brought here in modern times by collectors who supposedly then lost them here in America. However, in an article published in Volume 15 of the Epigraphic Society's Occasional Publications, hereinafter referred to by the acronym ESOP, Dr. Alberto Marini recorded a late Sumerian cuneiform inscription from Bolivia, cut on a stone bowl found near Lake Titicaca. It is a religious invocation addressed to the supreme deity, praying for blessings and guidance in growing grain and herding farm animals. It is associated with archaic Amara hieroglyphic signs incorporating some cuneiform letters, and thus it is a Native American product. It is not an import from abroad. And Dr. Marini holds degrees in Sumerology, including honorary doctorates from both the U.S. and Latin American institutions, and is at present a professor at John Kennedy University in Buenos Aires. He finds the grammar and vocabulary and the letter forms of the Titicaca inscription to imply a date of about 2000 B.C., and he deduces that persons who used the Sumerian language, presumably Sumerians, were present in the Altiplano at the era at that time. This important inscription is now in the Museum de la Paz, where it now may be viewed. Full details of the text appear in the succeeding volumes of the ESOP. The Tifneg alphabet, shown below, occurs in Bronze Age Norse petroglyphs, where it is used to render Old Norse words, omitting most of the vowels. A related form of Tifneg, I'm going to call this Tifneg, is used to this day by some Berber tribes in North Africa, whose ancestors may have acquired it from the Norse raiders in Bronze Age times, when Norse elements may have been included in the general term Sea Peoples. Well-known sites were such Norse inscriptions, or where such Norse inscriptions are those in Bohuslän, Sweden, where fleets of ancient ships are depicted below. In 1954, Canadian field geologists discovered a richly varied petroglyph site near Peterborough, Ontario, in which are featured ancient ships resembling those of the Scandinavian sites, interspersed with human and animal figures with numerous Tifneg letters between the pictorial elements. It was at first supposed the site had been created by the Algonquin Indian artists, though the local Indian people could throw no light on the subject matter of the carved pictures, and the archaeologists did not recognize the Tifneg letters. In 1982, in my book Bronze Age America, I deciphered the greater part of the inscriptions and showed that they are written in archaic Norse and relate to a religious religious center established by Norse traders who were exchanging woven textiles for copper ingots supplied by the Algonquin Indians. The age of the site was estimated to be such as to place it in the Bronze Age, and astronomical details included in the inscription suggest a date for about 1700 B.C. At the time, such transatlantic voyages by Scandinavians in Bronze Age vessels were unheard of, and my inferences were ridiculed by the Canadian archaeologists of Ontario. Since then, however, The Danish historian John Galster has examined the site, and his conclusions have been published in book form by the Dansk Historic Society in Copenhagen in 1987. Galster's opinion totally supports my decipherments and conclusions, and he was able to add further details from Scandinavian sites that match and support these inferences. The copper ingot supplied to the Scandinavian traders of the Peterborough site may have resembled the natural ingots shown on page 96, and they probably also included man-made hammered lumps of copper extracted by the ancient miners of Michigan. Some 5,000 abandoned mines have been found on the shores of Lake Superior. Boys and girls, did you hear that? Let me underline it. Some 5,000 abandoned copper mines have been found on the shores of Lake Superior, carbon dated by Professor Roy Dreyer of the Michigan Institute of Mining and Technology to between 2000 BC and 1000 BC, and while it appears that millions of pounds of metallic copper were extracted and cannot now be accounted for, Dreyer and his colleagues surmise that the copper must have been shipped overseas, and now the discovery of the Peterborough site seems to confirm that for Dreyer's account of the matter. See Prehistoric Copper Mining in the Lake Superior Region by Dreyer and DuTemple, published in 1965. Now I'm going to put a bracket around that. As I was educated here in the United States of America, and I never heard a word of it, much less 5,000 ancient copper mines around Lake Superior. I never heard of these petroglyphs here in the United States of America and in southern Canada, did you, when you went to school? Now, fortunately, when I did finally escape from the institutionalization of the public school system around 1957, I began a study on my own. My run-in with a teacher in high school ran something like this. We called him Shaliny Bean. His name was Shalinus. And when we got into the 10th grade, now I was really excited. First day in the 10th grade, I'm in ancient history. And now we're going to start with history. We're going to take a look at history from the Garden of Eden until 1955. That's about when I was in the 10th grade. And I was excited, and I came in, and I opened my textbook, and it began with Nebuchadnezzar around, 550 to 580 B.C. Now, as young and dumb as I was as a sophomore in high school, I knew that ancient history did not begin with Nebuchadnezzar, that there was time before Nebuchadnezzar. And I thought ancient history meant that you go back to the beginning. Ancient, beginning. It doesn't. And so, when we began, I raised my hand in class. Now, there's about 30 other kids in here. And I said, but Mr. Shalinus, this book begins. He began class, and he began with Nebuchadnezzar. And I said, but Mr. Shalinus, there was history long before Nebuchadnezzar. And he concurred. He said, yes, that's true. And I said, well, where do we start with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? Everybody laughed at me. And he kind of snickered a little bit, and he said, well, we're not going to go back that far. We're going to start with Nebuchadnezzar. And I was really disappointed, and I said, but history doesn't begin with Nebuchadnezzar. And now he got a little sharp with me. He said, Gordon, this textbook begins ancient history with Nebuchadnezzar. This class is beginning history, ancient history, with Nebuchadnezzar. And you are starting your ancient history with Nebuchadnezzar. And that's what reminded me of Galileo. It is true that when you're 15 years old and you're in Mr. Shalinus's class and the textbook begins ancient history with Nebuchadnezzar, and Mr. Shalinus begins ancient history with Nebuchadnezzar, and he announces, and you, Gordon, our beginning ancient history with Nebuchadnezzar. I got the drift of it right away. Ancient history begins with Nebuchadnezzar. But later after class, one of my classmates who was also ridiculing me, like the archaeologists of Ontario ridiculed and impugned this author, Barry Fell. I said to him, nevertheless, it was my friend David Wagner, I said, nevertheless, David, ancient history antedates Nebuchadnezzar. Of which David readily agreed. And that's the kind of intimidation that you young people out there in college run into. You walk into your college class and you raise the subject matter, and your professor is going to put you in your place in damn short order, partner. And you know it, and I know it. So, truth, then, is not the subject matter of higher education. Bottom line. And boys and girls, truth is not the subject matter of politics. Now, truth exists, and truth exists independently of politics and of higher education. I mean, there's truth out there. We now know, and everybody in the world, to my knowledge, now acknowledges that the world is, in fact, round. We now have pictures of it from space. And we also accept the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun. But that has not always been true in politics or religion. Nor has it always been true in academia. And the same thing now in nearly everything that we investigate or look at. I don't care whether it's politics, government, public institutions, they all lie to us. They lie to us about economics. If you want to know the truth about the economic circumstances of the United States of America, it's not in the Wall Street Journal. It's in the underground publication. And it's not a very pretty picture, and it's not a picture that your government wants you to know about. And so they hide it, and they lie about it. And the UPS, Reuters, and Associated Press all conspire together to hide it from you. So when you write me a letter and say, but why would they want to do this? Because they want to control you. And they control you, and they control your votes by what you think. Your church controls you by what you believe. Your colleges, your institutions of higher learning, your employers control you by your paychecks and by the academic degrees that they threaten to withhold from you if you don't adhere to the party line. Now, we used to laugh at the communists. If you don't accept and adhere to the political instruction of the Communist Party, you will not get your degree from the University of Petrograd. Just the other day, a guy pointed out to me, he said, you know, at the Smithsonian Institution, they sent a letter out to all of their curators in there concerning a subject matter. I don't remember what the subject matter was. And they said, now, if any of you cannot, in good conscience, subscribe to the official policy of the institution, we would expect your immediate resignation. Now, this is the Smithsonian Institution. This is the highest. This is the apex. This is the crowning glory of intellectual, of museums, of education, of science in the United States of America. It's the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And they plainly told their curators, if you can't subscribe to the official policy, then you can resign. To hell with the truth, you can resign. Now, in the Chicago Museum of Natural History in 1940, they had a skeleton, an ancient skeleton of a man, 14 feet tall, which corroborates the biblical story that in the ancient times there were giants in the earth in those days. That skeleton is gone today. I have a picture of it here. That skeleton is gone. It was there in 1940, or 39. Maybe it was in 40 that it disappeared. But it was there in the 30s, and in 1940, it disappears from the textbooks. It just disappears. Where it is today, I don't know. But it doesn't fit the theory of evolution. It doesn't fit the political and the scientific dogma of our time. And so therefore we remove it. And that's what Barry Fell is revealing in America, B.C. That the colleges and universities, when this evidence is brought to light, they bury it. They ridicule it. They impugn it. They make fun of it. And then they threaten you. And they say, if you can't accept Columbus as being the first person to discover America, or the discoverer of America, we would expect your resignation. Boys and girls, that's not science. That is not honest. It's not even academic. It is pure, unadulterated propaganda. Nothing more, nothing less. And we've all been taught to believe it. Now, I'm one of those that believed it. I mean, I went to public school just like everybody else, and I believed what they taught me. I didn't see any reason why Mr. Shalinas would want to lie to me, but he did. I couldn't see any reason why Mrs. Lowry would lie to me, but she did. And I couldn't see any reason why President Roosevelt would lie to me, but he did. And over the years, I have discovered that our society here in the United States, now I can't speak for you people in Canada and Australia, I don't know. Maybe you people are got the straight truth. Maybe you got the straight skinny from your teacher. But let me tell you, not here in the United States of America, not in the public school system in Eureka, California, or Ferndale, or Arcata, or Fortuna, they all lied to us. And the textbooks lied to us. And that's why textbooks have to be replaced constantly. Textbooks on science are constantly replaced. Not the Bible. The Bible and its pronouncements on science are always the same. They've been that way for 3,000 years. And every time we test them, they're always true, they're always accurate, and they're always correct. Not so the science textbooks. Not so the textbooks of the Middle Ages that told us that the world was flat when the Bible tells us it was round. That's right. Twice in the scripture, the configuration of the world is described as being round. Just thought I'd point that out to you. But it didn't fit with Catholic theology. And because it didn't fit with the theology of the time, it had to be banned. And anybody who would dare to say that the world was round was branded as a heretic. And that's what happened here to Barry Fell and Gloria Farley. They were branded as heretics, archaeological heretics. Fortunately, though, over time, as is always the inevitable outcome, the truth eventually, little by little, comes to light. And then people like Galileo and Barry Fell and Gloria Farley are vindicated long after they're dead and buried. I mean, they personally have always been ridiculed and impugned. But after they're dead, then those of us, you know, who slowly but surely discover the truth and publish it, and you know, the Johnny-come-latelys like yours truly here, George Gordon is a Johnny-come-lately, I come along and say, wow, look at these guys. They knew the truth long before the official... The officials at the Smithsonian Institution and the President of the United States and the scientists and the archaeologists of academia today. Well, in 1977, Professor Gad Rusing suggested that Scandinavian Bronze Age voyages may have occurred, his evidence being the bronze axe shown on this page and now located in the Museum of the American Indian, New York. Scientifically, or significantly, the axe was found in Ontario. So, here's a Bronze Age axe. Nothing like it ever discovered among the American Indians before or since. But here it is, and it's found in Ontario, Canada. It's sitting in a museum in New York. How come we never heard about that? Here's Barry Fell standing next to the famous Las Lunas inscription on Hidden Mountain, New Mexico, lower left, Fell, who reported 1985 on the punctuation. This is a big rock. I mean, he's standing next to the rock. I'll describe it for you here. And this rock is probably three times bigger than Mr. Fell. He's got his hand upon it. Lengthways, it's probably 6 feet. And sideways, that is the narrow direction, it's probably 3. It's a stone about 3 by 6 feet. Looking at it here, it's probably 12 to 16 inches thick. This rock is so big that it probably weighs, 10 tons. 10 tons. And he's standing below it, and where it's located from where he's standing, it's over his head his head's about 6-8 inches up from the bottom. He's got his hand on it. This is called this remarkable version of the Hebrew Decalogue or the Ten Commandments, located on Hidden Mountain near Albuquerque, New Mexico, became the main focus of attention during the Epigraphic Congress, sponsored by the Western Chapter of the Epigraphic Society in 1984. The inscription, written in ancient Hebrew letters of the style of the Moab stone about 1000 BC, was not translated until 1949, when Professor Robert Pfeiffer of Harvard University recognized it as a short version of the Ten Commandments as given in the 20th chapter of Exodus. For long it was thought to be a modern engraving until the examination carried out in 1984 disclosed anomalous features that may imply an antiquity. The geologist George E. Morehouse, reporting in ESOP, that's the Epigraphic Society Occasional Publication, Volume 13, published in 1985, found patina indicative of an age from 500 to 2,000 years, and Fell, reporting in the same volume, noted that the punctuation matched that of ancient Greek manuscripts, such as the Codex Sinaiticus. Sinaiticus of the 4th century AD. All right, hang on a second, boys and girls. Let's pause here for a moment in our closing minute or two. The Ten Commandments are found in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They've been there for at least 2,500 to 3,500 years. How in the hell did the Ten Commandments get there? And why weren't you told about it? Because it doesn't fit with evolution, but it certainly fits with the scriptures. We don't want you to believe in the Bible, the Ten Commandments, or God, or special creation. We want you to believe in the Republican Party, in the Democratic Party. We want you to believe in science, archaeology, politics, and Columbus. For you to know that in New Mexico, the Ten Commandments are found, written in Hebrew 2,500 years ago, doesn't fit. And you're not supposed to know that. So we hide it. I say that is intellectual dishonesty. That is pure propaganda. All right, we're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about America BC by Barry Fell next time. But you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.